There we go. All right, so today we are exploring the book of Ruth. You know, I am a huge fan of women in the Bible. I think it's mainly because I don't know if you've ever heard of the notion of a breakout text. It's this time when everything is kind of going normal, and then all of a sudden it kind of takes a 90 degree. Like it takes a hard right or a hard left, and you didn't expect that. Like in the book of Judges, where Barak, who is supposed to be the judge, doesn't rise up, and all of a sudden, there's Deborah. And you're like, wait a minute, male judge, male judge, male judge. All the judges are males. All the prophets are males. And all of a sudden, a woman. But at that time, women were treated as property, as chattel, possessions almost. They could be bought and sold almost. It's amazing how diminished their personhood was. And yet, we have female prophets, prophetesses. We have female judges. We have daughters inheriting as men. And so we have these things that are called breakout texts in the Bible where it kind of violates our expectation, or at least what seems to be the text's expectation. I'm a huge fan of those. So Ruth is one of those stories where the Bible elevates a woman into a position of the spotlight. Esther was another. Before we get going too far, I want to share a story with you. Back when I was in my early 20s, I was hanging out with a friend late at night, and a couple nights a week, we'd hang out till like 3 o'clock in the morning. We'd play board games or listen to music or whatever. It was fun. It was summer. We weren't in college anymore. It was time to relax and do dumb things and be sleep deprived when we go to work, as most early 20s are wont to do. Anyway, so one night, usually what happened, I'd get a ride home and we'd pull out kind of through an intersection and there's a red light and we'd stop out in the crosswalk past the stop line. It frequently happened. And we'd just sit there, wait for the light to change, and on we'd go. And so it was something I was used to. On the way home, we'd hit this intersection, the light would go red, and we'd stop in the crosswalk and carry on after the light changes back in our favor, because we obeyed the law. So we wouldn't run the red at night at 2 o'clock in the morning when there's no cars anywhere and no risk of anything, but we'd still obey the law. Well, this one particular night, we pulled out across the crosswalk, stopped like normal. And I got this funny feeling like, we shouldn't be doing this. So I turned to my friend who was driving, and I was just about to say something, and they looked at me kind of funny, put the car in reverse, and backed up 8 feet. Way behind the stop line. And just kind of looked at me funny. And I'm looking at them. What happens next is very important. So I'm going to leave that right there for a minute. Today we're talking about Ruth, and probably the single uniting characteristic of Ruth as a breakout text is that Ruth was open to God. So we're going to talk a little bit about context first before we explore that a little more. Ruth occurs in the period of Judges, and there's two kind of ideas about when chronologically that is. So you have the early Exodus theory and the late Exodus theory. The early theory is before that and puts the conquest of the land around 1400 BCE, or before the Common Era, or what a lot of people are used to saying BC, before Christ. If that's the case, it puts the book of Ruth at about 1225 BCE, right about 200 years before the reign of Saul. Now, it's interesting because in this chronology, we notice outright about the book of Ruth, what it shares in common with the book of Esther, which, interestingly, I noted last night, most of our stories, like Nehemiah, like the one next week we're doing on Daniel, like the one in 2 weeks that we're doing on David, most of the characters that we're looking at this summer, except for the New Testament ones, have no direct action by God in their story. There are no miracles in their stories. And yet these are stories that are rich with instruction on faith. So whether or not it's the late or the early Exodus event, the timing of Ruth puts it around 1150 to 1225, roughly. Now this is significant because it's actually an indication of one of the earliest archaeological evidences. I'm a huge geek. I love this stuff. Archaeology is so cool. So this is one of the earliest archaeological evidence for the existence of Israel. And it's one of the pharaohs of Egypt, Merneptah, who he carved this little stone just explaining how awesome he is and how great he is over all these other nations and how he did such a great job. And it mentions Israel just once. And at the bottom it says, Israel is laid waste. Its seed is no more. And I think the hieroglyphs are really cool. There, up there you see a little picture of a man and a woman. And just to the right of it, that's a symbol that represents a thrown spear, meaning a foreigner. So Israel, thrown spear, man and a woman with three lines indicating descendants. This is saying that Israel is identified as a nation, not as a person, and not geographically. Not like Canaan, the land of Canaan, which you identify with the Canaanites, and Moab, which you identify with the Moabites. This is Israel, no connection to land. So it's interesting in 1205 that Merneptah identifies Israel as a distinct nation, not inherently connected to a land. This would suggest a later chronology. Now it's interesting that he says their seed is no more. People have argued that means he destroyed them, but other people have suggested that it means that this is during a time of drought or famine where there's no fertility in the land, so they're not a threat, which would line up with our timing for Ruth, because what happens in the early opening sections of Ruth? There's a famine in the land. Judges 3 talks about the Moabite oppression. In fact, the whole book of Judges is oppressed by the Ammonites, the Moabites, the Philistines, you know, and it's hard to remember where all these nations are. They kind of crowd around. So I got a little graphic here, the Phoenicians, the Philistines, the Edomites, the Moabites, the Ammonites. And if it's hard to remember, I always kind of use something to help me remember this a little bit. So you had the Israelites, the Midianites, which were down below Edom. You had the Ammonites, and I'm not really sure where the Overbites fit, but they're in there somewhere. Maybe just south of Judah, but... but it fits. I mean, so Ruth occurs between Jerusalem and Moab. And Ruth is a superlatively told story. It's a beautiful story because it draws on such incredible dynamics. So this is what we're going to explore today. So Ruth can easily be divided into four sections. The first two is Ruth demonstrating her love. The next two, the last two, is her love being rewarded. So we have this really amazing progression in the book of Ruth where we go from death to expression of care by Ruth to expression of care for Ruth, and then life, from death to life. We go from Moab being a foreigner and an outsider to the fields of Bethlehem, to the threshing floor, to the city. And so we have this progression from foreign and outside to the very center, to the very heart. This movement from outside to inside, which parallels Ruth's movement in her own life, being a foreigner, an outsider, one excluded from the promises of God, moving to the very center of God's promises. So the book of Ruth is a wonderfully told story that draws on these dynamics. We're going to explore those a little bit. So, in chapter 1, it talks about the story of the judges, the famine that's in the land. This is after Judges 3, because we know they're not being oppressed by the Philistines or by the Moabites because they're at peace with them. So, it is not uncommon to sojourn in a foreigner's land when you didn't have any food. That was fairly common practice. We remember from the story of Joseph, all of Israel packed up and headed down to Egypt. It was common for you to in a sense, rent land in a neighboring country that wasn't during famine. So this is what Ruth and her husband did, Elimelech. And they traveled to Moab, and their sons married foreign women. Ooh, something they're not supposed to do. You know, it's interesting. In the book of Ruth, names are very telling, very important part of the story. Ruth means blessed or happy, joyous. Her husband, his name was Eli Lamech, or Elimelech, but Eli means my God, and Melech is king. My God is king. And so he was clearly understood to be a man of great faith, just from his name. Naomi was understood to be a blessed woman. And they had two sons, whose names were Mahlon and Chilion, or Chilion. Now it's interesting, the meanings of those names, Mahlon means sick, kind of pale, weak. And Chilion or Chilion and Kalon means finished, but it sounds almost like Kilvan, which means destroyed. So when you have a fire, you're out camping and you start a fire, when is the fire finished? When it's completely destroyed, it's completely burned out. And so Killian's name has this connotation of he's used up and ruined. So it's setting the stage of this chart. We're going to leave this up so you can kind of copy if you want and use it as a framework. So these two sons that she had from the man whose God is king and blessed has these two sons that are due to die and pretty much dead already. So the stage is set. We know what's going to happen. And she has two sons. These sons get married. They marry these foreign women. And these women are Ruth and Orpah. Fun little anecdote, if you didn't know this, Oprah, her name was actually supposed to be Orpah, and her mom spelled it wrong. The two girls are not dissimilar, Ruth and Orpah. When her sons die, Naomi says to them, go back to your families. Go back and find a new husband. May you find comfort and peace and safety, because a woman without a man was vulnerable. She had no protection under the law. Her testimony as to what happened was considered half or less. So if a woman said something and a man said something, the man was correct and she was not. Her testimony didn't count. If two women said something and a man said something, they were considered equal and the man's testimony would count. If three women testified about something, only then would it be considered more trustworthy than a man's testimony. Three against one. Sounds like my house. We got three. No. So Naomi says, go back. Why would you wait? Why would you wait in the hopes that I would have, maybe get married, maybe have another son, and then, you're going to be, 35, 40 by the time he's old enough to be a husband to you, to have kids? Like, that's not fair to you. Go back, be free, remarry, have a life and a future. And Orpah said, on it, see you later. And she took it and went. But Ruth did not. You know, and that's one of the stunning things about Ruth. One of the things we talk about, the openness of Ruth, is that Ruth was at the very start very receptive to wisdom, very receptive to input. She listened to what people had to say and then made the choice whether to heed that or not. And it's interesting because when we look at the biblical narrative, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, all the way through David, Solomon, all the way through all of our biblical characters, the defining characteristic of them was not their moral performance, was not their goodness, was not their obedience. It certainly wasn't their obedience, because we know how much of a mess some of the patriarchs are. The defining characteristic of them was that they listened for an encounter with God and walked in that. You know, Les opened our service with the reminder out of John's prologue that he gave us the rights to become children of God. Not disciples, not students, not followers, but children. You know, this week in particular, you know, we've really experienced that with our oldest. She is very disobedient sometimes. She does not follow the rules. She does not listen. And that's being a kid. That's being a child of their parents. I mean, if you have a kid that's perfectly well-behaved, congratulations. We don't. That's okay. Most of us don't. And the truth is, there's life in that. There's life in their disobedience, not because they're willful and bad, but because they're learning boundaries and they're learning health. And let me be explicit with you. As a child of God, if you come to church and you want to be a child of God, just like me having my children, this is the place to come and make mistakes and be loved. This is the place to come and be imperfect and learn to do it right. Here, only here, will you find people that understand your brokenness, understand your mistakes, and will work to try to love and forgive it and help you grow. Well, and unfortunately, in church, there are some of us whose brokenness is that we are judgmental and unforgiving, and we're working with them too. So this week was a hard reminder for my daughter that obedience, listening, and obeying is the path to life. Not because we're about rules or morality, but because we're about relationship. And when someone loves you and they want what's best for you, they want to guide your life. To listen to wisdom and to obey it, not a rule, but to wisdom, is life-giving. And so that was a hard lesson for her this week. Ruth already knew this lesson. So when her mother-in-law piped up, Naomi says, "Go back to your families." Ruth said, "No, I've committed to your God. When I married your husband, I was in." She goes, "Wherever you go, I go. Your God, my God. Your people, my people." Ruth at the outset demonstrated what it meant to be a child of faith, a foreigner who understood the heart of God. So the stage is set. They leave. Ruth implores her all the way through to verse 18. "No, don't make me leave you. We're doing this." And then verse 19, they return. And immediately the story introduces Boaz. And it says, "Now Naomi had a relative of her husband's, a worthy man of the clan or the family line of Elimelech, my God is king, whose name was Boaz. And Ruth said to the Moabite, let me go to the field and glean among the ears for grain after him in whose sight I shall find favor. And Naomi said, go, my daughter. So she set out and gleaned in the field after the reapers. And she happened to come to the part of the field belonging to Boaz, who was a clan of Elimelech." And I'm going to pause there for a second. The social system of the day, this was the equivalency of the food bank, welfare, and social service, like the entire support network system, was the gleaning process. So what they would do is farmers were not permitted to sweep through their crop a second time. So if I planted a field of barley, which is what we're going to encounter in the story, it was this barley season. You'd plant a field by broadcast spreading seed. You didn't plant it in rows, and you didn't have it furrowed. You had a field, and you scattered seed by hand. So you get clumps, and you get sparse patches, and so it'd be kind of all over. And so when it came time for the harvest, you would line up all your relative males, and they would line up in a group, and they would kind of proceed across the field and pick everything they could grab at a slow walking pace. Never stopping, but at a slow walking pace, gather as much as they could into their bags, hand the bag off, done. And then usually what they would do is they would then send their women immediately behind. And then women would, again, at the same pace, do the slow walk of picking up any grains that the men dropped or that fell between their fingers, because they're not allowed to scoop and pick the grains that they drop. They're not allowed. So the women would pick up the grain that they dropped and pick up some of the scrap grains that had been left on the stems. Then anything that was left was for the people that were homeless, unable to work, disabled, foreigners. And so they were given freedom to go into the field and pick up whatever was left. And usually it was, you know, maybe a cup of grain a day. And so they would use these things to gain nourishment for the day, usually. That would be their hopes. So one cup of grain would be sufficient to sustain two or three people. So it was, you know, half a pound or a quarter pound of grain was all a gleaner could hope to gain, enough to keep you from starving. So Ruth headed out to glean. And I love this because verse 3, I don't know if you could see it in your Bible, but look at chapter 2, verse 3. So she set out and gleaned in the field after the reapers. And I love this next verse. We translate it horribly. We get it completely wrong. And she happened to come upon the field of Boaz. Okay, let me rephrase it for you more accurately. And against all odds, her chance chanced upon the field of Boaz. This text is almost winking at you. It's like, yeah, sure, she lucked on the field of all the fields in around Bethlehem, of all the relatives or non-relatives, all the Jewish land owned in and around Bethlehem, she just happened upon the field of Boaz. Sure, it was luck. Her luck lucked upon is the way it reads in Hebrew. Right? Sure. And she came upon the field of Boaz. Now, it's interesting. Boaz comes out, and he says to the people, "The Lord be with you." He said to the reapers, "The Lord be with you." And they answered, "The Lord bless you." Now, it's interesting because this is almost a priestly greeting. I don't know if you knew that. The Lord be with you is what priests would say to people under them, the regular people and the people who are considered less spiritual or less close to God, would say it to them. So it's the kind of thing that the pastor, the priest, the religious service performer would say to the people. He would say, "The Lord be with you." And we actually see that in Catholic churches and Anglican churches that emphasize tradition. And the people would say, "Well, we don't have the power to make that pronouncement. We hope he's with you, so may the Lord bless you." And so that's what they've said. They say, "The Lord bless you." Boaz turns and he says to the young man who's in charge, "Who's that? She doesn't even look like us. She's not an Israelite." And the servant in charge says, "She's the young Moabite woman who came back with Naomi from the country of Moab. She said to me, 'Please let me glean and gather among the sheaves after the reapers.' So she came and has continued from early morning until now, except for a short rest." The young man points this out because it's pretty fantastic for two reasons. One, the field owner usually only shows up at the end of the day to keep people from carting off full bags of grain. If I owned a field and I had a bunch of guys working on the field, when are you most likely to steal grain from me? Big stack of bags right there, end of day, just and off we go home with it. So that's usually when the field owners show up, is at the end of the day, 10, 12 hours in, into the day. And so this guy points out that this person who is in the class of lazy and not hardworking and not responsible because they don't have a job, that's their attitude, those foreigners, those lazy people, she's been here from early morning, and she's barely rested. So she already, Ruth is differentiated in the mind of Boaz and these men. On top of that, she asked for permission to do something that she was entitled to do. She didn't just follow the rules, she went beyond the rules. And so it caught Boaz's attention. So Boaz approaches her and he says, "Now listen, my daughter, don't go somewhere else. Don't go glean in another field or leave this one, but keep close to my young women. Let your eyes be on the field that they are reaping and go after them." And it's phrased as a question in most of your Bibles, but it's rhetorical in the Hebrew where the answer is obvious. Haven't I told them to leave you alone? You're under my protection, daughter. Which is shocking because you remember our order of harvesting. You had the men harvesting, then the landowner's women would follow, and then the gleaners. He's just promoted her from the back row to the middle, where if the guy dropped a full head of grain, she's allowed to pick it up. So now her prospects of getting grain at the end of the day goes from a cup and a half, to up to 4 liters. Almost enough food for sure to be well-nourished and possibly several days of food. So Boaz is already being exceedingly gracious. And I want to point out, we see in this story this movement from emptiness to fullness, from destitution to security. And so Ruth is showing her care for Naomi in her diligence and her dedication. And so Ruth sees what they have, he has said this. And in fact, he says, not only have I told him not to touch you, verse 9, he says, when you're thirsty, go to the vessels and drink what the young men have drawn. You don't even have to work for your own water. He is treating her as an Israelite woman, a married Israelite woman. He is giving her everything that somebody on the inside might be given. He's giving that to her. And she goes, "Why have I found favor in your eyes that you should notice me since I am a foreigner?" And Boaz circles back. "Why? Why, Boaz? Why are you doing this?" And Boaz says, "All that you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband has been fully told to me. And how you left your father and mother and native land and came to a people that you did not know before. The Lord repay you for what you have done, and our full reward given you by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge." Okay, so I love this little passage. There's lots of songs that make reference to, like, "I sing in the shadow of your wings." And I don't think we fully understand that. I mean, if you know, great, but I'm going to help you with this. Back in the day, you had your clothes, and then you had a cloak. And the cloak had the double purpose of protecting your clothes from damage, from thorns and briars and dust. It kept your inner garments clean. It protected you from the wind and the hot sun. But it also doubled as a blanket at night. So your cloak was a very personal article of clothing. It was representation of your presence. Wherever your cloak was is where you were. That was just kind of normal. Everyone's cloak was an indication of their presence. To take someone's cloak was, in a sense, to go about in their presence. So on the cloak, the bottom edge, the sharp corner at the front, the 90 degree, that was called the wing of the cloak. And you would use it to kind of cover things. Like we saw with my daughter running up here. if we were back then, she would have been inside, in the shadow of my wings. It was a symbol of closeness, of protection, of intimacy, of safety. So here, Boaz is saying, under whose wings you've come to take refuge. Boaz is recognizing, not only did she leave everything, he says, but I get it. You've walked away and embraced our God. May he honor that. May he love you. He recognized that Ruth went far beyond the moral code of the day. Far beyond it. And so he was eager to reward that kind of goodness. So on top of that, he sits her down at mealtime and even passes roasted grain to her so she has something to eat. And then he urges the men, fill up her bag. Fill up her bag from what you gathered and leave it for her. And then he says, and now on top of that, whenever you go ahead of her, you guys, the ones that are in front of her, I want you to just drop some grain. Oops. Leave some behind. Already we're starting to see, much like what God does in our lives, Boaz is doing it in the life of Ruth. So Boaz is a Christ figure in some ways. This is a conspiracy of grace. Boaz isn't just being kind. He is going out of his way to orchestrate grace and love and acceptance for her. A true Christ figure. So she gleaned, and she beat it out, and it was about an ephah of barley. Verse 17, it says it's about an ephah of barley. Now, if you're like me, you're like, what in the world is an ephah? And you Google it, and it says it's about 23 liters. So that's the equivalent of almost 30 pounds of grain. That's one of those big ice cream buckets. That's for a woman, that was considered a normal full day's work of grain. So it was astonishing that a gleaner would get that much when their biggest hope was this cup. So she takes this and she heads back to her mother-in-law, and her mother's like floored. Naomi goes, what? Where did you glean? Where have you... Some man must really be happy with you. And so she goes, oh, Mother, here's what happened. The man's name with whom I work today is Boaz. And Naomi said to her daughter-in-law, may he be blessed by the Lord, whose kindness has not forsaken the living or the dead. That man is a close relative, one of our redeemers. The Hebrew word is goel. It's in the Song of Miriam, in the Exodus event, she says, he is our goel ga'ah. He is our kinsman redeemer. He is this. Praise the Lord our God. He has redeemed us. He has brought us up out of our emptiness into our life. He has brought us from slavery into freedom. He has brought us from death to life. And Ruth says, he is our goel. And so she says, you shall see. So Naomi said to her, Ruth reported, here's what he said to me. So she kept close to the young men of Boaz, gleaning until the end of the barley and wheat harvests, and she lived with her mother-in-law. Interestingly, if that was her takeoff of one day, Ruth and Naomi would have had enough grain not only to survive, but to be able to purchase a small piece of land and a house off of what she gleaned in just those two crops. So they were well provided for. So Naomi sees this and says, "My daughter, should I not seek rest for you? Like, you're gleaning every day. Should I not seek some comfort that it may be well with you, that you may sense the good life, the pleasure of God in your life? Isn't Boaz our relative, the one who you were with?" You know, Naomi's almost trying to set up a blind date from the looks of it. In fact, she says, "Look, see, he is winnowing barley tonight at the threshing floor. Wash, therefore, get washed up and put on your cloak and go down to the threshing floor, but don't make yourself known to him until he's finished eating and drinking. When he lies down, observe the place where he lies. Then go and uncover his feet and lie down, and he will tell you what to do." And she replied, "I will do as you, all that you say, I will do." So the threshing floor was where all the harvesters drop their grain, and then you'd use a fork, like a pitchfork, to kind of separate the wheat from the chaff there. And usually you'd throw it in the air, and the wind would carry away the chaff, and it would leave you your grain. And it was common practice for the landowner to sleep at the threshing floor at harvest time to prevent theft. You'd either have the owner or the owner's son, and they would be there to prevent theft of the grain. So it wasn't uncommon. This was typical. But big grain, big party, we're so happy about the harvest, people get they have a little to drink, they're happy, they're feeling a little warm. Boaz had done this. He was sleeping at the feet of the grain under his cloak. Now, it's interesting. Naomi's advice to Ruth said, "Then go and uncover his feet and lie down." Now, I want to correct some of our understanding in this text. The feet in biblical texts were considered unclean. It was also euphemistically a reference to your genitals, which, kind of connects with our current lingo and colloquialisms around, person's genitals referred to as their junk or their uglies. It's consistent that the feet were referred to as, you would refer to your genitals as your feet, so you'd keep them covered. This is not what the text is saying. Just so that we're clear, Naomi is not saying to Ruth, "Go and proposition Boaz on the threshing floor when he's in a good mood." You look at that in the text, you're kind of like, is that what she's saying? Especially when, if you read the Hebrew, it feels a little bit like that. But you see the conduct that comes out of this, and there's no mistaking it. There's no possibility that that's a reading of the text. And the Bible texts are notorious for preserving our failings, our brokenness, our bad decisions. One look at the life of Abraham, we see it. One look at the life of Jacob, we see all the times they lied and cheated and stole. And it's incredible. Here in this story, we see nothing. She appears before him. He's, in fact, shocked. "Who are you? What are you doing here?" She goes, "I am Ruth, your servant. Spread your wings over your servant." She says, "Look, please protect me. Take me into your comfort, protection, and presence, for you are my goel. You are my bringer of life. You are my mover from outside to inside." Boaz is moved by this. He says, "May you be blessed. You have made this last kindness greater than the first in that you have not gone after young men, whether rich or poor. So do not fear, I'll do all you ask. But there is one closer that is more entitled. Remain tonight, and in the morning, if he will redeem you, good. If not, then I will do it." So she laid down, and before anyone could recognize anyone, she got up and left. And Boaz headed it off. He said, "Let it be known that the woman came to the threshing floor, where women aren't allowed." And he said, so immediately he called for himself to be accountable. "Guys, I was on the threshing floor, I had a little bit sleeping there. The woman came to the threshing floor. nothing happened. So if there was any question of his conduct, he already headed himself off. He already outed himself. So it's clear that Boaz is a man above reproach. So he says to her, bring the garment you're wearing and hold it out. And he measured out 6 measures of barley, almost a week's worth of work. And she went in the city and she ran to her mother-in-law, and her mother said, well, how did you do? And she goes, well, he gave me this. You must not go back empty-handed. And as her mother-in-law says, until you learn how this matter turns out, wait. For the man will not rest, but will settle the matter today. In a sense, we're set up the picture of Boaz. Ruth, in demonstrating her love from the death of family to her care for Naomi, we now see Boaz's care for Ruth and his preservation of her character and identity. Even though Ruth did things that were a little bit morally questionable, maybe, her heart was special, and Boaz recognized that, and the people of Israel recognized that. And so we see Ruth's love is being rewarded. And so chapter 4 is our major turn point in the story. We shift our focus from the story of Ruth and Naomi to the events of Boaz. And he sits down and he basically sets up a courtroom here, legal proceedings. He sees the guy that's the redeemer. He says, you, come on, hip, grab a seat. We got business to do today. The guy's like, okay, sure. So he sits down, and then he calls over 10 elders, which is the jury, the judges. He calls them in, they sit down, and he says, okay, here's the deal. Tells them about Ruth and Naomi. Actually, he's clever about this. He just tells them about the land. He says, look, our mutual relative had this land that needs to be purchased from Naomi in order to keep it in the family, because otherwise it falls fallow and can be claimed by foreigners. So buy the land from her, and it stays in the family. The guy's like, cool, I'm good with that. To which Boaz goes, oh, whoa, hold on. It also involves the mother-in-law and Ruth. You get 2 dependents with the deal. At this point, the guy goes, okay, I'm out. I already got a wife and kids. Not doing that. he says, well, that'll threaten my inheritance. I got to provide for my own family. And if it's an extra field, well, then I can get a little ahead financially and give a better inheritance to my kids. But if I have to father a child by this woman, and he's not considered my family, and he has to inherit half my land, I'm basically doing this for what? For nothing for me, all for my dead cousin. And so he says, nope, I can't do it. And so Boaz says, okay. Then they do this weird thing where he trades shoes. Have you ever read that? Doesn't that kind of seem strange? It was a way of indicating contract. By trading, by handing your shoe to someone is an indication that you're not going to be able to flee. I'm binding myself to this agreement. Here's my shoe. I can't go anywhere. Where am I going to go? You've got my shoes. I've always heard it said you should walk a while. If you have a real fight with someone, a real big argument with someone, and it's based in Jewish law, if you ever get in a big argument with someone, you should walk a mile in their shoes, because then you have their shoes and you're a mile away. But Boaz says, I'll do it. So he redeems her and he marries her. And he hands off the sandal and she has a child, and everyone says, we're witnesses of this. And the capstone of the story, of this progression from death to life, from outside to inside, the story capstones it with this picture of the result of Ruth's obedience, the fruit of that obedience. Not her moral behavior, but her faith. Now, she gave birth to a son. They named him Obed. He was the father of Jesse, the father of David. And so it traces a line. And then the shock that they didn't tell you the whole story is they rewind it. Now, these are the generations of Perez. He fathered Hezron. Hezron fathered Ram. Ram fathered Abinadab. Abinadab fathered Nashon. Nashon fathered Salmon. Salmon fathered Boaz. Oh, my goodness. Do you know what that means? Perez, Hezron, Ram. Do you know who Nashon married? You know who Salmon married? Rahab from Jericho, the prostitute. The son of an outsider, the son of a despised foreigner, a person that betrayed her people to choose God, a person that went from the outside to the inside, a person that said, I choose your God over my own people, my own ways. His mom. And so Boaz, in his older years, meets a woman who has left her people, left her God, left her family for his God, for his people to follow God. Boaz is seeing a woman of immense character and morality and love. And faith, just like his mom. And you never knew that. So when we look at the context, again, because context is key to everything. It is to understand the context changes everything, doesn't it? All of a sudden, who Boaz is all of a sudden this shining triumph. He's a prince among the Jews, the son of a foreigner. It explains why he cared so much for Ruth. So in this picture, we see the recap of Ruth. It's set in the context of the period of the judges, where the rule is everyone did what was right in their own eyes. And what happened in the book of Judges? People were cutting people up and mailing them. They were committing adultery. They were worshiping at other gods. And in fact, the most stunning part was that Moses' grandson led Israel into idolatry. That's the context. And there was no king in the land, and people did what was right in their own eyes. Well, guess what Ruth does? Ruth flips the script. They're both written at the same time. So Ruth, she didn't do what was right in her own eyes. She did what was right in the eyes of God. And a big part of that was her openness and her receptivity to the wisdom and love and relationship that God offered. And so she was open to God into questioning her morality, the basis of her existence. She was open to God in terms of her relationships, going, no, I'm going to side with my husband's family, not my family. I'm going to side with what honors God, not with what makes me feel good. And she was open to God giving direction and wisdom in the less obvious ways. And so, just like Israel moving from a time of famine to prosperity, the life, like Ruth's, that is focused not on morality, but on relationship. It's focused not on our sufficiency, but on God's sufficiency. It's not focused on moral perfection, but is focused on obedience to the leading of our Father. It's one that springs to life. So from this, our lessons are very straightforward. I want to remind you, relationships with God are not based on moral performance, because Ruth was doing some things that weren't necessarily morally upstanding. What we do or don't do isn't what makes God happy with us. God loves you already. That's never going to change. The question is, what are you doing to embrace and enjoy that love? What are you doing to experience the walk of love and faith relationship? Our second lesson, real wisdom isn't doing what's right in your eyes, but more about being like God, taking on God's character. Ruth got it. Ruth said, no, I'm going to hesed. I'm going to commit to mercy and faithfulness. Let me get things wrong. But I'm committed to being steadfast, trustworthy, loving, forgiving. It's a mistake to read the Ten Commandments as a moral code to tell you what to do and what not to do. The real heart of the Ten Commandments is an invitation to take on the very character of God. And when we understand the Ten Commandments in that light, which is what Ruth is inviting us to do, which is what Esther invited us to do, which is what really all this summer, all these characters that we're talking about are inviting us to do, is to take on the very character of God, take on the heart of God. And in doing so, last thing to say about it. Love compels what law can never command. I'll say it again. Love compels what the law could never command. And lastly, you may never comprehend or see the fruit of your obedience, because Ruth never knew that her grandson was going to be the king of Israel, that he would be the starter of the Davidic covenant with God, the usherer of God's reign on earth, and the prefiguration and seed from which the Messiah would spring. And when we turn to Matthew chapter 1, we never expect, but there she is, Rahab, Tamar, Rahab, Ruth, our breakout women, who get more credit than some of the other men in the lineage. Because openness to God, being willing to receive wisdom, and seeking to be having the character of God will produce fruit that you're never, never going to see the end of. Jesus said something to that same effect, that faith multiplies so much that all the birds of the air can take shelter in it. So as we close today, I want to invite you to think about how are you willing to surrender your idea of who is God? What is your idea of wisdom that maybe you're a little too committed to? Maybe your idea of what makes for a good Christian that maybe you need to surrender? Because in Boaz's willingness to embrace the foreigner, with all her imperfections, he found the heart of faith that was far richer, far more valuable, and far more usable by God than any morality could ever hope to accomplish.